Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. I have Kevin Nguyen, author of New Waves and his most recent book, Me Document. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, I have to start by saying you are the first Kevin Nguyen I've ever had on a podcast. It is not lost on me. It's a comedic moment, but welcome to the podcast, Kevin Nguyen.
Yeah, it's so funny. I finally met a Kevin Nguyen in person at a bar in the Lower East Side. And we were joking. We're like, oh, we actually, like, considering the meme and the prevalence of Kevin Nguyen, it's like, we're the first, like, it was the first time we'd ever met another one. And he told me this great story about how he matched with someone on a dating app, and he almost went on a date with another Kevin Nguyen. And I was just like, I can't believe you didn't do that. Like, I will go on a date with you right now just so we can tell
exactly
that story.
You got to have that story. That's a funny story. As I go through your latest book, Me Document, there's so many things I want to comment on, but it's pretty intense, because I think that when authors start working on a book, it's not like, you know, you don't finish these things in a few months. It takes years to finish, right? And the timing of this book, you know, I think I read a review somewhere that says, or in an excerpt somewhere, there was like, Manzanar 2.0 is a description of the backdrop. And in order for you to have, like, really thought of the plot and the character development of this book, it should have taken years to come up. And we are on the precipice of something that could happen like this. And this is the craziest thing. So can you walk me through sort of the journey of how this book came together? And then we need to talk about who you are and your journey in the world of writing and editing and all of this wonderful stuff.
Yeah. So I originally conceived of the concept of the book. I think I had texted my agent in 2018. I was just like thinking of what my next book would be. New Waves hadn't come out yet, but I, you know, wanted to start working on the next thing. And I don't know, I've been a journalist for a while, and a lot of the reporting I had worked on was about migrant detention. I've edited a lot of stories about that. At the time, I was kind of very deep in Vietnam War books. And then also, since college, I've been reading off and on about Japanese incarceration during World War II. And so, like, all of those things were kind of swirling in my mind when I came up with this idea of a novel where, you know, a U.S. policy echoes Japanese incarceration and locks up a specific community of people. I also wanted to write a book about Vietnamese people, so I made it happen to Vietnamese people. But yeah, so this was 2018, so this is, what, 7 years ago. I will say, like, I've been getting a lot of text messages, and the reviews have said, you know, like, the book is timely and prescient, which I know are all compliments, but I didn't write it to be that kind of timely. You know, like, you want, the book pulls a lot from, like, what has happened in history to imagine the scenario of the book. And as I was writing, I was like, oh, like, it would be fun to imagine this kind of, like, dystopian landscape, you know, just like this heightened reality. And now I'm like, yeah, where it's April of 2025. And a part of me is like, wow, I should have heightened it a little more.
Are you horrified at how things are turning out right now?
I am. I'm really concerned. It's also hard too, because I've been covering a lot of stories about, you know, what's happening to the students at Columbia. I think that actually is the scariest part for me. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I actually think the thing that's most alarming to me is that people generally don't seem freaked out enough. Do you feel this way?
Yeah, 100%. I think that people in our community, the Vietnamese Americans that I know, are actually celebrating what's happening right now. Yeah, get those criminals out of here. Who cares about due process? There's an El Salvadorian mix-up. Let's just leave them there. And then the president of El Salvador is like, no, that's cool. I'm not going to do anything about the mistake. Like, fuck, I don't get that. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I mean, that explanation was crazy to me because both Trump and the El Salvadorian president were just like, oh, we have no power to fix this. And I was like, what? Like, all you guys do is talk about how much power you have. And like, you can't just like rectify one mistake. And I don't know, that's the strangest thing about, I mean, maybe it's pretty consistent with Trump. He just like, it's like never admit defeat, never admit a mistake, you know? It's everyone else's problem, even when like the facts are just in front of you.
And that's the scary thing about, I'd like to hear about some of the migrant detention stories that you cover. I'm working on a project producing with some of that mass deportation in the film space. But I'm always interesting to hear migrant stories because I think that this is such a small, tiny population that's being used for political reasons. But at the end of the day, it's very telling about the direction we're headed.
Yeah, I think, well, so the Department of Homeland Security is only 22 years old. I think there's just kind of this like myth that like, this is the way things have always been, but actually the formation of ICE is it's recent history, right? And so like, whether or not you feel like we should be accepting some level of immigrants in the US, it's just like hard to reckon with the ways like we treat migrants. It's actually funny. I found, they tell you as an author to never read like the Goodreads reviews of your book. I just like read them all anyway. I actually think it's kind of healthy to just see what people are attached to and also what they don't like. But I remember one person was like, it's like, I can't imagine the US like locking up, you know, 2 million Vietnamese people. And I was like, I could see that. Maybe it's a little outlandish. And then they like the review went on to say like that the US doesn't really have capacity to incarcerate that many people. And I think that is an outlandish statement. ICE detains 250,000 people every year, you know? So over the course of a decade, millions of migrants have moved through detention centers. We have the capacity, you know? That is just that is indisputable. And in fact, we're increasing the capacity, for all of like the budget slashing of DOGE, which, you know, obviously did not add up to what Elon Musk had promised dollar-wise. We are multiplying the budget of ICE by 10. You know, Trump just announced that like the budget used to be $3.4 billion. And I believe he said he's going to commit $45 billion to ICE now. So like, I don't know, like the capacity for what Homeland Security, what ICE can do to migrants, to now to US citizens, like that is only getting greater. And that is like the broad effort of this administration.
Man, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, and I don't think that all of this is far-fetched. And you know, when you think back, the stuff that was happening right now is far-fetched, right? Like, if you think about it 5 years ago, the stuff that's going on right now is like, it's unimaginable.
Yeah. We're like, the government is disappearing people for their free speech. It's like just totally nuts to me.
And we are living it right now. And at what point does it stop?
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I don't know how if you feel this way. Like, I just feel kind of helpless. Like, we can go to the protests. It doesn't seem to do much, which doesn't mean we shouldn't stop showing up. But like, what else can we do? This administration feels truly no shame. They just lie to us constantly. Now they violate every court order. You know, like, what are we supposed to do?
Yeah, and I talk to people of sort of, you know, I hate being so divisive in my stance about this stuff, but I talk to other people that are like, you know, in our camp. I hate using that, but I mean, it's a it's a distinction but then again, there's, like we talked about in the beginning of our podcast episode, there's family members that are so happy that Trump is in office, and their businesses are suffering. My uncle's businesses are suffering, and they're still celebrating this leader in their world. So there's a lot of people, I think there's an overwhelming amount of people that are really in support and see, you know, it's like one of those pictures where, like, when you see blue and then somebody sees white, it's
yeah, like the dress.
Yeah, the dress. You know, we see, you know, a completely different color and reality than they do.
Yeah. You know, I would say one thing I love about your podcast, like, you had Viet Dinh on, like, just like a figure that I had been fascinated by for a long time. And I was like, wow, you got him. You know, like, that interview is like a text. But I think a lot of the inspiration for me writing this book is, I mean, I think there's like a famous stat that gets thrown around that among Asian American communities, like, Vietnamese tend to swing the most Republican.
Yeah.
And I should say, like, I have no, like, I don't think everyone needs to be liberal. You know, I don't think everyone needs to agree with me. But people, do you get this? Like, people always ask, oh, like, why are Vietnamese so right wing? You know, I actually think on the whole, we're not, it's just relative to other Asian communities, perhaps. But it's fascinating. Like, the Vietnamese diaspora is so concentrated as like a single wave of immigration. And that, like, makes us quite distinct from, you know, Japanese or Korean or Chinese Americans. Like, there were very few Vietnamese people here before 1975. Like, now there are a lot of them since 1975. And the other thing, too, is, like, you talk to, I have a lot of conservative family, like, it's kind of impossible to talk to them about immigration. Like, we had some rare and generous policies that allowed Vietnamese people to naturalize. Not that, like, people's journeys were not easy here, and I don't think that process was actually that straightforward. But, you know, like, we have not extended that same courtesy to Afghan refugees or Syrian refugees. And so every time, like, one of my conservative aunts is like, well, you know, like, we came in the right way. It's like, there's no right way, you know? It's like, you were allowed through, like, specific policy that does not exist anymore.
But that's the problem, Kevin. It's the nuances that the generations that are a little bit older than us, they're armed with just a little bit of information.
Yeah, from Facebook.
Yeah, or YouTube videos on conspiracies. And I'm always open to my family saying these things and listening and not fighting and just allowing them to speak, because I don't want the disruption. I don't want to, you know, anger anybody. And what are we going to do? Like, it's a healthy debate. You know, why fight and why go to town with each other and break? Because obviously there's more of them than me in a family. Whenever I show up, there's more of them. And the younger ones are just sort of indifferent. They've checked out. Young people, I think, in my family have checked out. They don't really want to learn about the nuances. The problem is, you know, again, the real issues is not really understood. And that's the issue. The issue is that the issues are not understood very well. And I feel like even when the seat that I'm sitting in right now is I'm asking questions all day, every day, and I'm still in the dark about certain things. And I wouldn't dare make these assumptions about certain topics. I'm just here to like ask more questions. But I have family members who are just so adamant about what that they're right.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what that, it's kind of funny, especially when you write like a novel about like, you know, I was like, I want to write a book about Vietnamese people. And I just like, it was hard to know like what things felt like broadly Vietnamese or what things were like just my family. But I do think that like there's this kind of stubbornness that does feel like kind of Vietnamese.
Yeah.
It's like, are we just stubborn people?
Yeah, I think it's a cousin of resilience. Stubbornness is related to resilience. And I think that, I think the older generation feels like they owe the Republicans, you know, for helping them out. Mm-hmm. I think there's a deep allegiance to that way of thinking.
Yeah. It's so interesting too. Like my grandfather on my mom's side, he was a colonel for the South Vietnamese Army. And he voted Republican his entire life. Like going to hang out with him just meant like listening to Fox News very loudly while he like stood in front of the TV like this, you know, cross-armed. But like he loved Obama. Like Obama's second term was the first time he'd ever voted for a Democrat. And he hated Trump. And so at the same time, like it was like very cool to watch him change. I'm not sure what information he got, you know, because it's not like he stopped watching Fox News and he was like too old for Facebook. But so I never want to like cast things too broadly across Vietnamese people.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just, I just like don't know where certain things come from. I feel like I'm losing my ability to speak to that older generation. But then sometimes they surprise me, like as my grandfather did.
Yeah, that's what a breath of fresh air coming from that generation. I love it when I hear that. How did you get started with writing?
Yeah, I've always written. I never thought of it as a career. I was just doing it on the side. I graduated in 2008. So how many financial crashes have we had since then? But basically, we weren't any jobs. So I was just working at like very low levels of startups and tech companies for the better part of a decade. And I was just writing, I was writing a little fiction, but mostly writing book reviews and journalism, the kind of stuff like I would stay up to like 3 a.m. working on some essay for The Atlantic for like $200 or something like that. And actually, the $200 was meaningful at the time, but you know, just I just never thought it made sense as a career. My parents thought it would be very silly to do something creative for a living. You know, they wanted me to try and move up at these tech companies.
You were working at the tech companies. Were you working as inside? What did you do at the tech companies?
Honestly, like nothing that interesting. You know, I worked at Amazon for quite a while, and I was just like, they called like, the job was like merchandiser, and like, I would literally just like make little widgets on the website, you know, totally non-technical stuff. It's actually funny. I have like a lot of like resistance to AI taking our jobs, but I was like, that's a job AI could do. So really like quite low level things like that, just paying the bills, just trying to send a little money home. And writing on the side. And then like around, my 30s, I was actually at Google. That paid okay. It was also like a job where I made lots of PowerPoints and played a lot of ping pong. And then I just like made the leap to journalism. So I worked at GQ for a few years as an editor. And now I'm at a tech website called The Verge. And then I'm just like in my free time, I write fiction.
You know, working at Google and then you nonchalantly say, oh, I just went over and made a lateral move to GQ. Like, all right, explain yourself.
It was, I mean, it does feel, it's a strange leap. Well, I also say, like, a lot of people at my field in journalism are kind of like doing the opposite thing. They're like leaving journalism to go to tech. And so going the other way around is a little easier in some ways. But yeah, that was a job. I just like went through the front door and just applied for a listing. So
yeah. So your time at the tech companies gives you some backdrop for the book. And, you know, it's interesting to read like the word, a Googler, right? You're at Google and you get these, you get like this special insight on like the protection or the vibe that, you know, that you're in a different class of people.
Yes. I also think it's the kind of workplace that a lot of like Asian Americans at large aspire to be at.
Yeah.
Because it is prestigious. It is well compensated. You know, actually for a big tech company, I'll just give it to Google. Like they do, at least the teams I was on tend to respect work-life balance. But at the same time, I just really did not enjoy being there. Everyone was so engineering focused. I remember having a conversation, this is probably like 2014, 2015, but an engineer was like confused why we say Black Lives Matter instead of All Lives Matter. And truly like just, he earnestly did not know and was receptive to me explaining, you know, like what that distinction meant. But that was like kind of a lot of the people I worked with, just like totally isolated from the rest of the world. I actually remember I had to look something up in the Google directory. So, you know, I just like punched in my last name. And for a company that is based basically in San Jose, there are very few Vietnamese people that work there. You know, it's like there are a lot of Asian people, of course, but I don't know, like I found that like kind of shocking for the company that was just like, I don't know if you've like been back to San Jose in a while, but like the rents there are insane.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to wrap my mind around, and when I was reading the book, I was thinking about the choice to put the Vietnamese people in the context of this and the marketability, the commercial viability of having Vietnamese characters. And turning off all of the people who are like, you know, readers who don't understand the difference between Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, right? This is sort of like a book that could, if it was dystopian, maybe Mexicans, I don't know, that it would might open up a little bit more. And did you have to like really calculate this idea of putting Vietnamese people in the book?
This is a great question. I honestly was not thoughtful enough to worry about like the audience or the marketability or the reader. I think one thing that always sticks out in my mind specifically about Japanese incarceration is it's kind of random.
Yeah.
You know, like it was a lot of Japanese American farmers on the West Coast who had nothing to do, you know, with like their native country. So it was just like all political, right? And so I wanted the experience for the characters. It's like had nothing to do with them or who they were or anything that they'd done. And I think we're obviously seeing that play out pretty strongly right now in contemporary times. You know, like one of the people they sent to El Salvador, right? Like just like had tattoos that they just assumed were gang signs or something. And like, I don't know. So I think I wanted, just narratively too, like as a novel, you have like four characters and like the rug kind of gets pulled up under them for a page like 40 or 50. So I feel very lucky. I just want to shout out like my publisher, One World. They were very supportive of everything in the book. Like they didn't worry about it like a Vietnamese market being too small or something. They were worried about a certain kind of reader. They also publish, you know, like Ta-Nehisi Coates, Ibram Kendi. So like, They're very good at going to bat for their authors. But even with the book's title, you know, it's got a word with a diacritic in it. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't bat die.
Wow. You're privileged. It's a
I know. Like I love that like Vietnamese people get to pronounce the book slightly differently than everyone else. Because most people say my documents, but you know, you and I know it's me documents.
Yeah, I want to get into this. You know, it's in one of my questions. It is a really cool title because of, I mean, you might express that it goes two different ways, but I would say it probably goes four or five different ways for me, right? Because my documents is my documents, which is, you know, and in the English pronunciation, and me documents is American documents, right? And but me also means beautiful, beautiful documents, mm-hmm. right? So there's a there's actually like other things that could be derived from that title. It could go a lot of different ways.
I know. That's like the fun thing about the Vietnamese language.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I will say like I'm not fluent in. And I actually spent a couple months in Saigon in the winter. And man, did my Vietnamese not improve at all.
You said, man, did my Vietnamese not improve at all? You're a funny guy, Kevin. Why did it not improve?
I just, you know, well, one thing, like, the Vietnamese, like, we're raised with as Vietnamese Americans is quite different, right? I think, you know, the way people in Vietnam would say it's like our Vietnamese is almost like isolated in time from like the 70s. So, like, we don't have any of the slang that Vietnam has developed in the last 50 years. So, just like, and, you know, I think, even though I think I read as Vietnamese, in Vietnam, I think they just like caught that I was American pretty quickly too. And my partner is white and like, I don't know. They just like, they knew I was like other quite immediately. So I would like try to speak a little Vietnamese with them and they just be like, yeah, don't worry about it.
I do want to return back to this idea of the publisher taking a risk and not giving you any hard time for taking that direction and not once saying, hey, you know, maybe we switch it up to some people who are more popular, you know, let's switch up to the Mexican population, right? That would make more expansive and make easier sense of how this can go down. What do you think is sort of like the calculus for a publisher? And I'm interested from a business perspective, because I think I'm so grateful that they do that, you know?
Yeah.
But wow, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to talk, or I don't want to speak too much on like how my publisher makes business decisions, because I don't necessarily know. I'm like really thankful that they take a risk on me. But the realities of book publishing are very odd, I would say, in that most books lose a lot of money. Even successful books lose a lot of money. And then the ones that do make money, they make so much money that they like make up for the rest of it. And you compare that to like another creative industry like Hollywood, where they're just like so well calculated that like every movie is basically, well, maybe until recently, but like basically every movie is like kind of close to profitable. And then they like writes out all the taxes so it looks like zero to the IRS. But like, there's just like some tinkering there that's like really impressive in Hollywood. And then book publishing does not have that at all. Like they kind of publish a lot of books and then they know certain things will really take off and certain things won't. And the really interesting thing about book publishing that I think is quite generous to authors is you get paid in advance. And it's kind of like what they see as like the potential for the book. And when your book does like not meet the advance, it's like fine and normal. You just get to keep the money. You don't get any royalties yeah. until you pass the advance. But I think in a way, it allows someone like me who's like, I want to like write books that are transgressive or surprising or unexpected. Like I'm not trying to write toward a market. I'm not trying to write toward a specific reader. And so like not worrying about the business part like frees you up to write books that have concepts that kind of, I think a lot of people aren't, I'm like, a lot of people aren't going to like what this book is about, you know? I think a lot of Vietnamese Americans are not going to like what they see in this book. And that's like kind of the point.
Why do you say that?
I think a lot of the impetus of the book, like I was saying, you know, obviously there's a strong conservative bent among Vietnamese Americans. But I also think that a lot of our people don't know our history. Like, obviously, the project of your podcast is to expand that knowledge and preserve it. But I'm almost like more concerned, not just like the lack of access to it, but the lack of curiosity about it. And then also the lack of curiosity of how our experience like does or does not connect to other Asian American experiences. Because I think at the same time, I have a deep skepticism of the wide umbrella of, you know, AAPI. I think our experiences and cultures are so vastly different. And then sometimes I think when we like all group together under a big tent, I think Vietnamese experiences especially kind of get lost in the mix.
You know, when I'm with people who are sort of, who are Vietnamese, who are not interested in the cultural space, I often think about what goes on in their head when they are, quote unquote, fully assimilated in the white culture, or, you know, I'm in Houston and, you know, they're all hanging out with, you know, cowboy boots and cowboy hats on and I'm hanging and I'm, you know, just, you know, being a part of that world. But there's no question in their mind where they fit in. No, they're white. They fit in. Yeah. You know, that's the construct. And why are we even bothering that construct? You know what I mean? That when I look at it, I'm like, that's the question I have. I'm like, why do I need to bother these people who are so into their world? It doesn't matter to them. And by the third generation or fourth generation, it even matters less because they've married into white families and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, that's a good question. On one hand, I will say that like the folks who just like don't have questions or unbothered, like, wouldn't it be nice to just like live in that headspace for a little while? Like, I'm honestly like a little envious of it.
Yeah, me too.
But I don't like actually want to do that. Like, I think, I just think there are consequences for not understanding your history. You know, like what we're seeing, part of the book too is, you know, I did not learn about Japanese incarceration until I got to college. You know, like I think in middle school, I did a whole year about World War II and it just like never came up. And even my American history class in high school, I think we spent 2 days on the Vietnam War, which seems ludicrous to me. And so, you know, Trump especially has invoked the Alien Enemies Act, which, you know, is from the 18th century, but is more famously how FDR basically got his executive order for Japanese incarceration to happen. And we're just invoking the same things. Like, we have all decided that Japanese incarceration was, like, abhorrent, you know? Even the Supreme Court has ruled that it was a mistake and it violated the Constitution. And we're just doing it again. And I think partly because people don't know the history or aren't curious about the history. Yeah. And I think another thing too is like, so the characters in the book, they're all in their like late teens, early 20s, you know, like young people just living their lives, like trying to be successful, trying, you know, I don't think they'd use the word assimilate, but that is what they're doing. And like, can you blame them for not knowing their history? I think a little bit, but also like not entirely, especially too when our parents don't necessarily pass those things down, you know? My parents didn't really talk about the war for a very long time. So I had to go out and learn about it on my own. But I also understand why they didn't want to talk about it. So there are some of like, the nice thing about writing a novel is you can sort of embody these ambiguities and these conflicts, and you don't necessarily have to, you know, come out and say, ah, like dads should be better about telling their kids about the war or something.
I get asked often who the audience for the podcast is. And then when I read books like yours, I understand that you wrote it for me, right? That's how I feel. But do you ever ask that? Who's your audience? Or do you write for yourself? Or do you write it with a guy like me in mind? Like, who are you?
Yeah, I think, I like quite selfishly, at least at the beginning, I'm writing for myself. You know, like, especially I think anyone that like makes art, like you kind of imagine, like you just want to see something in the world, right?
Yeah.
And so you make it. And that's part of the pleasures of creation in all its capacities. But it's, you know, like once it gets out in the world and people start reading it, it's interesting. Like, I don't know how much like you and I have in common, but from this conversation, I feel like we have a lot in common. And also just like, it's not just like our background, but it's like the questions we have about the world and the things like we want to learn about ourselves and our community. Like, that's fascinating. And I actually don't think the reader of this book, there's a lot of stuff that's like not specifically Vietnamese, you know? So they're on some level, like, I'm not necessarily like imagining like strictly a white reader, but like even other like Asian American readers who like, I think take certain things about Vietnamese culture for granted. Like that's like a really interesting conversation to have with people when they read the book. But yeah, but I think it's probably a bad answer, but I kind of didn't think too much about it as I was making the thing.
And I imagine a book on the scope of what you did with New Waves and what you did with Me Document is a years long process. And when I think of a book that somebody like you create, I think of it as sort of almost as another person, as a character in your life. And I'm wondering, before you met this character, you were probably a different person. And then after getting to know this character, this book, this work that you finished, you got to know another entity. How has that getting to know that character changed your life? Has it even changed your life? I imagine it might have some effect on your life changing sort of direction.
No, that's actually like a really eloquent way to put it. I do feel like quite a different person having gone through the process of writing this book. You know, I mean, I worked on it for, what did I say, 7 years?
Yeah.
Like, so I've also aged, you know, that's a big part of it. But I put a lot of the questions and anxieties that keep me up at night and in the book, you know? And that's not to say like the book is just like a big ball of anxiety, but it was like, I don't know, I feel like I was able to pull something out of myself and put it on the page, and maybe other people will see that in themselves as well. I think that would be like a very satisfying reading experience. But yeah, no, you're right. I think working on something this long, being in the headspace of the book, finding, you know, like the narrative and the characters and the humor in it has sort of changed the way I view like my community, my work, you know, how I talk about it. So yeah, that's a really good question.
Thank you. I would love to hear your thoughts on, you know, providing advice and for aspiring writers in our community. What kind of words would you say to younger people who are aspiring in the creative field?
Yeah, I think I would say that you have to really like doing the work. It's not always actually fun, but the best part of writing is the days when it's like coming together. And I feel like my ratio for me is like 1 out of every 4 days of writing, it's like feels really good. But I think it makes up for everything else, and it's a lot of effort. I wish we lived in a world where creative work was more valued, in a sense that we actually value it quite a lot. Like, we think it's important, we consume a lot of it. We just don't have a lot of, you know, protections or resources for the labor that goes into making those things. But all that said, I think it's kind of freeing. Like, I have always had a full-time job as I work on these two novels. And, you know, like I had to stay up late or I had to write in the morning, or weekends were dedicated to this oftentimes. But I thought it was worth it. And I think the goal should not be necessarily to get published. I think it's like pull those things out of yourself, put it on the page, do the work, read a lot of other work. And I do think good things will come to you, but also I think the work itself should be the satisfying part. And I've been thinking about this a lot too, because I see a lot of young people writing with AI. And I actually like am not too judgmental of like people using AI as a tool in general. But I do think writing, any kind of creative process, art making, is like a series of like human decisions. And I think you have to like really like making those decisions. When you offload that decision-making to AI, I actually think you rob yourself of the experience and the joys and the ups and downs. I think that's like what makes it valuable to an artist. And I don't know. And still like AI work is still, I think it's pretty identifiable still.
This is fascinating. And I think it'll lead into our next segment in terms of the future. And you live in the tech space and you cover the tech space, and this idea of using AI for art, using it as a tool to kind of like get the, I think it's a fascinating point because the nuances and all of these sort of the things that you scrape as you're scraping your brains and you're conditioning that muscle comes to the page when you're writing. But what if you use AI and you kind of bypass all that, and then you get to a point where you're like, okay, I got the structure down, and then you put the energy, the real energy that it takes to kind of like really build. Do you think that's a possibility, or do you think it comes up shallow and hollow if you don't do the heavy lifting?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good question, because it's also like, how do we define the heavy lifting? But I could see a world where like AI gets you started, you know. I heard recently from someone who used AI because English was not their first language, but they wanted to get their memoir down. You know, I think I try to not draw too many moral lines, but I really think if you're not in like the nitty gritty of the work, you just like have robbed yourself of an experience, you know? And then we have seen that the work itself is also weaker because of it. Do I think someone will create great AI art? I'm not sure. I think all the great art using AI is about AI, you know, and tends to be quite critical of it and quite funny and quite grotesque. But we'll see. I will say this, the way that these technologies are progressing, like, I don't know if my opinion here is going to hold for 10 years. But that said, I guess the other thing I'll say, like maybe specific to writing and AI, the reason it works so well is because it like has ingested massive amounts of text, and then it's kind of giving you like the sum average of that stuff, right? And that works great when you're like writing an email, you know, for work. I think if you're trying to write a novel or a strong work of nonfiction, no one wants to read the sum average of stuff, right? Like they want to read something exceptional, or they want to read something surprising or different. And the way we've trained AI increasingly is to make it more predictable. We're just like smoothing out all the edges. And I don't know. I just don't think people want to experience things that are predictable.
Do you think that we as readers and humans that consume content will begin to really be able to differentiate when it comes from the sum aggregate that you're talking about? Or if it's like truly, oh my God, this is so human. How did this artist like understand like, you know, these details that are so human? Do you think we're going to be able to detect that soon? Or do you think that technology will be so advanced that we cannot detect the human touch after a while?
Yeah, I guess at the same time, you know, I think people make this parallel all the time. Like, I just don't think AI is special. Like, we've had disruptive technologies before. People thought that Photoshop was going to destroy every photography job. It certainly eliminated a bunch of them, but we still have photographers and we still value their work. And in some ways, we might value it more than ever, even though the costs and tools to to take a nice photo have greatly, those barriers have greatly diminished. I think it's still easy for a photographer to make a living in creative fields. Actually, someone was telling me last night that the first synthesizer, what was it called? It was called like a melodica or something like that. I'll have to look that up. But it was like banned from a lot of different places because they were worried the synthesizer would put keyboardists and pianists like out of business. So it could only be sold to like these certain lounges and things like that. So
wow.
I think like we'll learn to wrangle the tools themselves. You know, I think every musician respects the synthesizer as an instrument now, but that wasn't the case necessarily 50 years ago. So,
yeah. And when I see a musician with a microphone and a piano or microphone and a guitar, and they're just doing that, and the magic of just being just in the moment and being able to have a skill set to convey all this, like, because you're an emotional machine at that point, right? In flesh and bone. Mm-hmm. And there's a magic and a beauty to that delivery in that moment. And you know, this is not a machine.
Yeah. You know, the other thing too, I think about all the time with AI is that like it only occupies a digital space, which is an important one, but it's also like, it's like not real. You know, like we take like these screens, we take them very seriously. But, you know, I always get like these snippy tech bros who are just like, oh, you work in journalism, like AI is going to take your job. I was like, are we going to teach AI to like pick up the phone and report a story? Like, I don't think so. I actually think that's like, on top of it being dangerous, it's not even the direction we're taking AI. I am a lot less confident it can do that. Like, can it like reaggregate commodity news? Yeah. And maybe some of those news writers' jobs will disappear. But I'm not sure if that's necessarily the worst outcome either. Like, it's like if you have to go out in the world and do a thing, which I would say is like most of what we have to do in our daily life, AI can't do it. We still can't have like, AI still can't cook anything, right? Like we all eat 3 times a day. AI is like no closer to like being able to like stir fry anything.
Yeah. It's a ways away. And then you still have the human performance element of, you know, going to a restaurant that has a unique chef.
Yeah.
There's that. What are you working on next?
I am working on a nonfiction book, but it's a little bit of a swerve. It's a biography of the Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto. And so, it's like just a lot of research and me trying to decipher things in Japanese. So
why him?
It's funny, we were mentioning synthesizers earlier. I think he's one of those figures that it's like, I think his name recognition is not very big. Like I've been telling people I work on this book and people are either like, I've never heard of that guy, or they're just like, oh, like I love that guy. And he's had this career that has spanned pop music, film scores, lots of ambient music, installation art, film, theater. And I kind of think through his life, like you can kind of understand the changes to music and music technology over, and his career was basically from the, 70s to, he passed away a couple of years ago. So like his kind of amazing 50-year span. And it's also a very different project.
I love it. I'm a huge fan of Ennio Morricone.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And to hear you diving into a film composer, Ryuichi, what's his name?
Sakamoto.
Ryuichi Sakamoto. I'll look that up. And but there's no, like when I think about my parents' hat on, I have to ask you, where is the commercial viability of like sinking the next 3 to 4 years into a book? You know, like, is that a consideration? But how beautiful is it that you don't have to worry about it and you just go for it? But like, what goes on in your mind to say, this is the next 3 years, I'm on that book?
Yeah, that's my 3 years is also like a pretty conservative estimate.
Yeah.
Part of it too is I've always felt good about balancing a day job and then the side project. And I really love my day job too. And I'm lucky that I have one that is very fulfilling and very impactful. At the same time, you know, I think when I was younger, I think my parents had instilled this in me. It's just like, you should try and make as much money as possible while doing the least work as much as possible. And I actually like, I think I just like 180'd on that. You know, I want to make enough money to live a comfortable life. Anything above that is not that interesting to me.
Yeah.
And then I just want to make space for me and my partner so we can do our creative work. Like, I think we actually have very modest ambitions in that sense. All we think about is how we just like make our lives able and open enough so we can have the space to do creative work and like maybe occasionally like make some nice meals.
Yeah, I think that's a very attainable but very zen way to approach the creative life. Because ultimately, what you're, as a creative, I think what you're really looking for is the flow state. And flow state as a creative is actually a heavenly state.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blissful state. Time goes by so, I mean, you can't even track time when you're in this.
I mean, also like, you know, like I have friends and family who are wealthy, I would say, or have done quite well, or have they've like fulfilled the ambitions of, you know, the American dream or, and then like so many of them are so unhappy.
Yeah. So many.
You know? I think they reach the end and, or they reach, you know, a certain amount of money or comfort. And then it's not even just like, what's next?
You're tapped
like,
out.
They also have like lost the ability to like know themselves in a way and know what's satisfying. And, you know, human beings are like, we're meant to struggle and have a little friction.
Yeah.
You know, kind of goes back to the AI thing. It's like, I think the fun of the creative process is a little friction and solving problems. And when you offload that, I think you lose the satisfaction of it too.
There is a thought that I have when I think about me documents, new waves, and now Reichi Sakamoto, this path that you're taking requires the sand inside of a pearl. What is it about this new book? And I'm just trying to get to know your process. And what is the sand that's rubbing you inside to create the Reichi Sakamoto book?
Yeah, I think, so he was very famous in the 70s because he was in this pop band in Japan called Yellow Magic Orchestra. And they were like the Beatles of Japan. Like he could not be at a restaurant or on the street without people like chasing him down and screaming. And you know, for a lot of people, I think a lot of artists, that would be like the height of a career. And he actually moved to the US and started making very different music. You know, he like more focused on the film scores. And then he won an Oscar for composing the soundtrack to The Last Emperor.
Oh,
and he kept doing films for the rest of his life. But like, he just kept pursuing a new different kind of art. And he was endlessly curious. I also admit like a lot of the records he made, of which like there are many records, like some of them are not that good, you know. He was just like so endlessly curious, and like the, you know, it's interesting too, some of the best work in my mind, and I think in his mind as well, is some of his like stranger or experimental ambient works that he made toward the end of his life in the past decade. And you know, like that stuff has very little commercial viability compared to the other things he'd done. And I don't know, I just like the idea that this guy was constantly reinventing himself just out of the pursuits of what he was curious about. And I don't know, I just like, there's something like so human about that. It just like removes like all of the capitalistic incentives from art making as much as one can. And yeah, like, I like the guy, like an artist that did not figure himself out until he was like in his 60s. You know, like I think he started to become really comfortable with the stuff he was making like only then. And you kind of see like how in a book, like that could be like a very exciting journey to be on. the reporting is really fun when you talk about artists. So yeah, I'm really animated by this book project.
I want to end with a question. I don't mean to put you on the spot or make you scramble, but if you could give me some of the creative, some Vietnamese creatives that you follow closely. Are there any?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. It's funny. It's like in the past decade, we obviously have an amazing crop of Vietnamese American novelists and poets, you know, like Viet Thanh Nguyen, Ocean Vuong. Some other writers I really like. She's more of like an art critic, but she writes a lot of stuff. Terry Nguyen is really great. She's very young and scarily talented. There's a poet I really like, Kathy Lin Che. She does a lot of things. She does poetry, installation art. She actually has a short film that just won at Sundance. She made it with a few other people, but it's called We Are the Scenery, and she just interviewed her parents, yeah, who were extras on the set of Apocalypse Now. And you can see this movie. I it's still running around festivals, but it just has this like amazing detail of apparently like Francis Ford Coppola just like on the set was eating a mango with the skin on and like sideways. And like, I like that image is in my brain every morning. I'm trying to think who else. Those are the ones that come to mind immediately.
That's fascinating. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the Vietnamese podcast. And I wish you the best of the next years to crank out more of the work that you do. And I look forward to reading your new work too. And I know that there's book tours and, you know, your time is, you're flying around. And if you're ever in LA, please reach out and I'd love to hang out.
Yeah, I'd love to. This was such a, like, I feel actually quite moved by this conversation. You know, I've been doing a lot of podcasts and interviews, but I don't know. I think the things we're curious about, our concerns they're different. It's really cool to be asked these very different questions.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Thanks for the kind words.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.